Republican presidential candidate within the primaries. But you've joined with Harry Belafonte, Eve Ensler, Kerry Washington, Noam Chomsky, Alice Walker, Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, and others in this Stop Hate, Dump Trump campaign. Why him at this early stage?
Well, I think precisely for the reasons we just heard, what was so disturbing is that the media have not asked him the tough questions. They have not taken seriously some of the most outrageous things that he said within days of saying that Muslims should not be allowed to enter the country. He was both on news shows and entertainment shows. And in that context, there was no interrogation whatsoever. At least no effective interrogation. It was like, oh, about that Muslim thing was something that Jimmy Fallon said. So effectively, because he's both an entertainer and a political figure, and because he generates massive ratings when he comes on to television shows.
We're going to have to leave it there. Kimberly Crenshaw, David Johnston, Scott Horton. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our website, democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
Cable Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month is A Streetcar Named Desire, showing Thursday, February 18th at 7 p.m. Winner of 5 Academy Awards and considered the first dramatic jazz score of a film, 1951's A Streetcar Named Desire remains a landmark which forced the medium into a new, raw, emotional, mature kind of expression. Again, that's A Streetcar Named Desire, Thursday, February 18th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Cable Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Oregon Student Nurses Association Convention 2016, Empowered for Excellence. That's taking place February 20th from 8 to 4:30 at the PCC Sylvania campus in Portland. This year's keynote speaker will be Dana Bjarnason, the Chief Nursing Officer and Vice President of OHSU. Topics covered by the conference include flight nursing, forensic nursing, veteran care, public health nursing, and more. Again, that's the Oregon Student Nurses Association Convention 2016, Empowered for Excellence, taking place Saturday, February 20th from 8 to 4:30 at the PCC Sylvania campus, 12000 Southwest 49th Avenue in Portland. The Oregon Student Nurses Association, working to lead the future of nursing. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, Portland's neighborhood theater since 1924. Independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, and salads. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, laurelhursttheater.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia has died, opening a vacancy on the nation's highest court.
Missile strikes in Syria have destroyed a Doctors Without Borders hospital and several other buildings, killing and injuring a number of civilians.
And we have a live in-studio interview with Elizabeth Thiel from Oregon Save Our Schools.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 15th, 2016. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Jenna Yokoyama. A Portland police officer has pled guilty to one count of official misconduct and resigned from the Portland Police Bureau following a criminal and internal investigation. On the evening of July 4th, Jeremy Pilaro was the first officer to respond to a domestic assault call. He later exchanged several text messages with the female victim, eventually appearing at her hotel room later that night. He reminded her that he would be writing the report of the incident and coerced her into giving him a massage. According to Multnomah County Senior Deputy District Attorney Chris Ramras, the woman's own account of events does not describe criminal sexual behavior, but does describe unprofessional behavior equal to official misconduct. As a part of his plea agreement, Pilaro will serve 18 months bench probation. His police certification has been revoked, and he may no longer serve as a police officer.
The evolving conversation on renter protections and housing policy was dealt another blow after a special meeting between House Speaker Tina Kotek and several industry lobbyists. Of the three provisions the bill takes up, a 90-day notice after a tenant's first year landed on the cutting room floor. Two provisions, a ban on rent increases in the first year of month-to-month tenancy, and 90-day notices for rent increases after the first year, as of now, have not yet been cut. Despite support for all three provisions in the House, further revisions will be needed to secure support among senators. The meeting with lobbyists also addressed SB 1533, which would overturn a statewide ban on requiring that some new housing units be set aside for residents earning below the median income. But advocates fear that renters who earn less or may be facing a crisis situation will likely not be sufficiently protected. In addition to these two bills, there are two others. HB 4079 would allow for experimental expansion of regional growth boundaries for affordable housing, and SB 1573 would allow cities to annex land without a vote, so long as everyone affected is in agreement. Kotek asserts that all four bills will be tied together, spelling out a certain death if one fails. She said they'll all have to pass.
On Thursday, the Portland City Council will consider three specific proposals related to the planned move of the Right to Dream 2 homeless camp from Northwest Portland across the river to Southeast Portland. One item under consideration would vacate a nearby street in order to make the camp larger. The other two proposals authorize the relocation of the camp. Mayor Charlie Hales has announced he will not allow public testimony on the city's new homeless camping policy at the meeting. The city has recently stopped most routine homeless sweeps and has announced plans to legally allow people to camp in specific areas throughout the city. The areas where people could legally camp between the hours of 9 p.m. and 7 a.m. include city sidewalks, unused city right-of-ways, and parking lots owned by churches and nonprofit organizations. The city council had planned on taking up these issues at the February 4th council meeting, but it was postponed due to a lack of quorum.
More than 50 enthusiastic demonstrators marched through downtown Corvallis as a part of One Billion Rising, a consciousness-raising event dedicated to addressing the global pandemic of violence against women. 1 Billion Rising takes its name from the statistic that 1 in 3 women will be beaten or raped in their lifetime, adding up to more than 1 billion women across the globe. The inaugural protest, which was held on Valentine's Day in 2012, now has participants in 200 countries, according to organizers. Shireen Hyrapeed, a co-organizer of 1 Billion Rising Corvallis, underscored the necessity of the gathering by referencing local organizations such as the Center Against Rape and Domestic Violence in Benton County, which had answered some 6,732 hotline calls and sheltered 118 adults and children.
The Portland City Council will discuss a new resolution on Wednesday. The resolution will require older homes slated for demolition to be deconstructed by hand instead of torn down with heavy equipment such as bulldozers. The resolution would only target homes built before 1916. Mayor Charlie Hales has stated the resolution would decrease the amount of material entering landfills and reduce the amount of toxic substances such as asbestos and lead-based paint from being released into the environment. Asbestos was commonly used as insulation and heating tape from the 1930s until it was banned in 1973. Lead paint was banned in 1978. Over the last 2 years, an average of 300 homes per year have been demolished to make way for the construction of high-density condo and apartment buildings.
The Oregon Air National Guard's 142nd Fighter Wing announced today it will conduct routine night training missions beginning tomorrow. The exercise provides essential training for the citizen airmen pilots in nighttime maneuvers, Guard officials say. The training will last until February 26. The flights involving F-15 Eagle fighter jets will be completed each evening before 10:30 p.m. The Portland Air National Guard base near PDX is on 24-hour aerospace control alert. as part of Air Combat Command and the North American Aerospace Defense Command, or NORAD.
U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia died on Saturday. The 79-year-old Scalia was on a hunting vacation at a Texas resort when he passed away in his sleep. The official cause of death has not yet been determined. Scalia's death opens a vacancy on the nation's highest court. President Obama says he will put forward a nominee to fill the vacancy, but he faces opposition from Republicans who control the Senate. Republican Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Senate GOP leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky both said that they want to wait a year until after a new president is elected and sworn in. To find out more about Scalia and his possible successor, KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with William Funk, a professor at William & Clark Law School and constitutional law expert.
Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia passed away this weekend. There's now a vacancy on the court. Could you speak for just a moment quickly about Justice Scalia?
Sure. Actually, he was a personal friend, one of my people who recommended me for my current job. So it's some sadness that I have to speak about his legacy, as it were. His biggest legacy was to make the whole discussion in constitutional law be about original meaning. Rather than talking about what the Constitution means today, he refocused the look at what did the Constitution mean when it was adopted, or the amendments, when the amendments were adopted. What was the meaning at the time? And once at the meaning of the time, he would say the meaning is frozen, doesn't change over time because of events. So that's clearly that's all the discussion today. Everything revolves around that issue. It's almost single-handedly, he brought the court to and the whole discussion in the academy to the question of originalism. So that's clearly his really major legacy, which he did both by writing opinions, and he was probably one of the more prolific people off the court. That is, he spoke, he wrote off the court, he wrote books, he was a frequent speaker in places, he wasn't afraid to show himself in the public light. So he spread the message in many ways.
Now, a particular interest, of course, President Obama has stated that he plans to put forward another nominee for the vacancy. The Republican leaders, Senator Grassley from Judiciary and Mitch McConnell, the head of the GOP in the Senate, have both stated they want the nomination to be put off until next year when there's another president. There's another session scheduled to start in a few days on the 22nd, and then there are more, of course, hearings to start on February 22nd and another set of hearings in March. What are we looking at? Are there any constitutional implications of leaving an empty seat on the bench, or on the other hand, if the Senate decides to stonewall?
First of all, the court goes on, even though there's eight members of the court, and to the extent that it's not a 4-4 split. In other words, as long as you have a 5-3 or 6-2 or 7-1 or 8-0 vote, everything stays just the way it always has. The only question happens is what happens if you end up with a 4-4 tie. And if you end up with a 4-4 tie, what happens is the Supreme Court decision is a nullity. There is no decision. So the court that ruled below, its decision becomes the final decision. And that's not unheard of, because it's happened before. There are a number of cases where it's been decided by a 4-4 split, sometimes because a justice recuses himself for a particular reason, leaving only eight voting justices. So there's nothing particularly unusual about having an eight-member of the court, even for as long a period as, say, a year.
We've so far seen a couple of names floated. The one, of course, Sri Srinivasan, who is a judge on the district court in the District of Columbia. Another name, Tom Goldstein from SCOTUS blog, was floating Loretta Lynch as a possibility. Any ideas about what we might see coming forward?
Everybody's trying to float the name of the person they'd like to see up there. But as a practical matter, no one's going to be confirmed. Majority of the Senate is held by Republicans, and they are not going to confirm anybody that President Obama nominates. I feel confident in predicting that. So his nomination of someone really is a sort of symbolic gesture. And, you know, if he picks someone who is picked on from his purposes on a political basis to sort of say, hey, we're Democrats and look who we've put up there, Now, it's one thing if you put up somebody who would be somebody that ordinarily the Republicans might actually confirm, then it might sort of embarrass the Republicans not to confirm the person, even though they still won't.
Do you think it's likely that the president will go ahead and do what he has said and put someone forward?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if he said so, I expect he'll do it.
So really, it's just going to be a question of what happens next and whether the Republicans decide to stonewall or go ahead for a vote and probably vote down.
I would doubt that. I would doubt that they would vote somebody down. I mean, whoever will be nominated will be somebody of high credentials that would be difficult to, on any principled basis, vote down. So I think it's more likely that they just refuse to either have hearings or they'd refuse to bring it forward for a vote. So I wouldn't expect anyone to be voted down, but I still don't expect them to actually confirm anyone. Well, it's, you know, whether you loved him or hated him, Justice Scalia was a personality, probably the best known member of the court in a sense that getting out there and talking to people and having ideas and trying to sell those ideas to the American people is the correct way to interpret the Constitution, which he thought was very important. You know, it resonated with conservatives, not so much with liberals, although his position with respect to the Fourth Amendment and searches and seizures was about as liberal. I mean, liberals would be happy with his position. So there were times that he made votes that were consistent with his ideals, even though they weren't what perhaps conservatives would otherwise have liked.
In fact, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I saw a reference that Justice Scalia was one of the key votes in the in a flag burning case.
That's correct. He was one of the votes, necessary votes to find a law banning the burning of the flag. He found it unconstitutional, and you know that's that sounds like it. Most conservatives would say you ought to be able to punish burning the flag, but he said that's clearly speech. When you burn the flag for it's a protest, that's clearly speech, and that's clearly protected.
Well, I've been speaking with Professor William Funk. He's at Lewis and Clark College of Law and a constitutional law expert. This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
The Federal Department of Education earlier this month released guidelines to help states evaluate and eliminate what it described as, quote, low-quality, redundant, or unhelpful testing. The new guidelines are coming after the newly adopted Every Student Succeeds Act, which was released last fall. What does it all mean? Well, joining us in the studio tonight is Elizabeth Teal from Oregon Save Our Schools. Elizabeth, thanks for coming into KBOO and joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth, first question, what's the problem with the current standardized tests?
Well, first of all, there's nothing wrong with assessing students. As teachers, that's what we do every day. But there is a problem with the way that we've been using high-stakes standardized tests since the beginning of No Child Left Behind. So standardized tests have been used to sort students, deprofessionalize teachers, and privatize schools. And although people treat standardized tests as an unbiased measure of teaching and learning, they're actually incredibly biased against students living in poverty and students of color. And in the last decade, thousands of high-poverty schools have been closed using standardized test scores as justification.
So, Elizabeth, how did you come to this issue?
Well, I've been a teacher for the last 13 years, and I came into teaching with a belief that public education is essential to democracy. And it kind of came as a rude awakening to realize that there were policies in place that really seemed to be designed to undermine public education.
Now, you come with a very interesting perspective as a teacher and as a parent. So first, what do you see happening in the classroom as a result of these standardized tests?
You know, well, I've worked my whole career in high-poverty schools, and over the course of the last 13 years, I've seen more and more emphasis put on standardized testing because test scores are high-poverty schools' lifeline. There's stakes attached to test scores at Title I schools. So there's been so much pressure put on principals and on teachers to gear learning towards the narrow set of skills that are tested, that come across in the data. And at the same time, funding's been shifted away from the things that really make school engaging for kids, the arts, physical education, libraries, hands-on learning. This year, or actually starting last year, we have a new test in Oregon. It's called the Smarter Balance Assessment, and it's for students in grades 3 through 8, and that's been a big change over the kind of standardized testing we even saw before that. The Smarter Balance Assessment takes 8 hours to complete, even for third graders. They do it independently on a computer, and the length of the test is longer than the SAT and the ACT combined, more than twice as long as the GRE, which graduate students take to get into graduate school.
No, third graders, they're, what, 10 years old?
Nine or 10 years old.
And they have to sit and take a test for 8 hours?
They don't do it all at once, okay. But yes, it's stretched out over many days of instruction where they're not doing the kinds of learning that you would expect your third grader to be doing at school.
And you're a parent, too. How old are your children?
I have two daughters in second and fourth grade.
And they have they taken the standardized test yet? Well, the fourth grader probably has, right?
My fourth grader, I opted her out last year, and I'll do so again.
And so as a parent, as you're kind of watching your third grader sit through these hours and hours of testing, how do you feel as a parent?
Well, I feel like it's such a misuse of the instructional time. That's not what I send her to school for. By the way, I love my children's school. They go to public school. They have fantastic teachers, and they've had a fantastic experience. And what they do in school, what they love about school, has nothing to do with standardized testing. It seems like a waste of time because there's nothing I could learn from a standardized test that I don't already know about my daughter from talking to her teachers and seeing the work that she does. The results of the test are a single number. For English language arts, you would get a score of a 1, 2, 3, or 4. And I can't imagine what I could possibly gain from seeing a number, whether it be a 1 or a 4 or a 3 or a 2 on the test, that I don't already know from talking to her and seeing her work and talking to her teachers.
Now, as a teacher, again, your other hat here. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you don't know about a student that you could learn from a standardized test, or do you already know pretty much like you do as a parent with your kids?
Well, one thing that people might not know about standardized tests is teachers aren't allowed to look at them while students are taking them. So I really can't learn anything about a student from a standardized test score. While they're taking the test, I can't see the questions. I can never know what things they got right or wrong. In fact, I teach English. And the test score that they get, maybe a student gets a single number of a 3. That includes questions they answered about a number of passages. It includes how they did on an essay, how they did reading independent research, nonfiction articles and stories. But there's nothing in there that tells me where their strengths are, where their challenges are. So I learn about my students from seeing the work they do in the classroom.
So, Elizabeth, former U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan was at a flashpoint for education reformers in part because he was the architect of Race to the Top and the Common Core. He's been referred to as the Testocracy Czar, the cute little nickname for him.
You got to get that pronunciation right, too.
And so as a teacher, can you explain, this Common Core and the kind of history with Race to the Top?
Yeah. So Race to the Top came out as a federal program giving grants to schools or states and school districts that they could compete for. In order to be able to compete for the grants, states had to agree to adopt certain policies that were spelled out. So those policies include evaluating teachers using test scores, evaluating and ranking schools based on test scores, and then using school turnaround policies on those schools, which include closure and privatization, and adopting what they called college-ready standards. As the result of Race to the Top, most states took on all of these policies and adopted a new set of standards called the Common Core Standards. And that's what we have in Oregon right now. So the Common Core Standards are a new set of standards. They're being used by many states across the country. They're purported to be more rigorous than previous standards and to prepare students for college. And they were developed with funding from the Gates Foundation. And they've been very controversial to educators, for one, because they're deemed to be not appropriate, especially for younger children, not developmentally appropriate. There were not teachers involved in creating the standards, and they have ties to corporations. And so all of those things really raise questions about the value of these particular standards.
But, I just want to stop you there for a second, because this seems crazy to me that teachers weren't involved in establishing the standards. Who was then? Bill Gates and his wife, or
not exactly. They were involved in funding.
Okay.
But so this has been something, and the blogger Anthony Cody has written about this. It's been a pretty veiled process. Where there was a team of people that involved university professors and also people from corporations, education corporations involved in writing the standards. There was a larger group of people who looked at the standards. I think there were a couple teachers who were out of the dozens on that committee, but they weren't developed in a process that really involved in any meaningful way teachers who actually work with kids and know what's appropriate to expect of a five-year-old versus a 10-year-old.
Now, what are your observations in terms of the effect on kids, these Common Core standards? Is that something that's foreign to them? They're not learning it in the classroom, and maybe they don't have to learn it in the classroom, or is it of any help at all, any benefit?
Well, I mean, I think that as teachers, we look at what our standards are, and we look at our kids, and we find a place where we use our best judgment to lead kids towards what we know they need and to meet them where they are. And so, to be honest, I don't know to what extent teaching has changed in every classroom because of the Common Core standards. I think there's a lot of emphasis, there's a lot of talk about how Common Core standards are about critical thinking, and teachers have always been teaching kids critical thinking. So I think it has more to do with the way that we're the pressure that is put on teachers and schools to get certain test results can skew the way that resources are allocated. So if it all comes down to how a kid does on a test, the structures of a building might start putting more and more resources into how to prepare the kids for that test rather than how to make a meaningful learning experience.
Well, talking about testing, I'm sure you can answer this question, how can families opt their kids out of these tests?
Yeah, well, last year, the legislature in Oregon passed a bill, House Bill 2655, which clarifies the right of parents to opt out of high-stakes standardized testing. It used to be that parents have that right, but they had to claim either disability or religion as the reason. They no longer have to do that. So the state's developed a form that anyone can get from the school office, and it simply needs to be signed and turned in.
Oh, Elizabeth, thanks very much for coming into KBOO. That was Elizabeth Teal of Oregon Save Our Schools. You can find out more about their work, and at the website I'm about to give Elizabeth, they can also find out about opting out for their...
Yeah, they can.
Parents can find out about opting out for their kids. The website is www.OregonSaveOurSchools.blogspot.com. Oregon Save Our Schools, all one word, .blogspot.com. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Ellen Thomas, a peace activist touring the country for drumming up support for a bill in Congress to abolish nuclear weapons. This will be followed by Labor Radio at 6, Of the Working Class, By the Working Class, and For the Working Class. Then at 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline, sharing Valentine's Day messages, a special program featuring Valentine's messages we've received from people in prison and their loved ones on the outside. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, rainy, likely, mainly after 4 a.m. Patchy fog after 10 p.m., otherwise mostly cloudy, with a low around 50. Chance of precipitation is 60%. Tomorrow, rain likely, mainly before 10 a.m., and patchy fog before 10 a.m. Otherwise cloudy, with a high near 58. Chance of precipitation is at 60%. Today in history, in 1804, the state of New Jersey became the last northern state to abolish slavery when its legislature passed an act for the gradual abolition of slavery. And in 1879, President Rutherford B. Hayes signed legislation allowing women to be admitted to practice before the United States Supreme Court. The quote of the day is from Coleman McCarthy, who said, "It's too easy only to blame the militarists, racists, sexists, and other pushers of violence for the mess we're in. What is harder is self-examination, moving beyond caring by looking inward to ask the personal question, what more should I be doing every day to bring about a peace and justice-based world, whether across the ocean or across the living room?"
It's 5:29, time for Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
Last spring, President Obama got downright crabby toward Senator Elizabeth Warren and muckrakers like me. He was irked that we critics of his Trans-Pacific Partnership kept pointing out that this corporate power grab would directly undermine America's very sovereignty. Under TPP, multinational corporations would be allowed to bypass our courts and go to secretive, corporate-run international tribunals effectively empowered to roll back our nation's consumer, labor, environmental, and other laws that they don't like. "They're making this stuff up," Obama wailed. "No trade agreement is going to force us to change our laws." But on December 18th, the president very quietly repealed one of America's consumer laws in response to a legal complaint that corporations in Mexico and Canada had filed with an existing international tribunal. In effect, the corporations used this secretive autocratic tribunal set up by the World Trade Organization to force Congress and Obama to change U.S. law. So much for the untouchable sovereignty of we the people. And now, at the behest of global oligarchs and plutocrats, Obama is asking Congress to extend this outrageous veto power to thousands of private multinational giants in the 12 countries, from Australia to Vietnam, that would be part of his TPP deal. To sell it, he's the one making stuff up. Put simply, he declared in February, TPP will bolster our leadership abroad and support good jobs at home. This is Jim Hightower saying, put simply, that's hogwash. Research shows that TPP will cost our country another 500,000 jobs and increase inequality by, quote, redistributing income from labor to capital. You see, inequality doesn't just happen. It's caused by deliberate decisions and deliberate lies of corporate and political elites.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
The City of Vancouver's Citizens Commission on Mayor and City Council Salaries will hold a combined meeting and public hearing at 3:30 p.m. Wednesday, February 17th. The Salary Review Commission was established in a city charter section approved by voters in 1994. Salary reviews are held every other year to coincide with the city's budget cycle. The Salary Commission consists of 5 members of the community who are appointed by the mayor, subject to approval by the Vancouver City Council. The commission's purpose is to study the relationship of salaries to the duties of the mayor and city council members and to set their salaries. The commission files the schedule of salaries for the mayor and council members with the city clerk by May 1, 2016, for inclusion in the city's budget. The meeting and public hearing next Wednesday afternoon will take place at the Vancouver City Hall at 415 West 6th Street. Free parking is available for visitors in the building's south visitor parking lot.
The union that represents California State University faculty is going out on strike this spring. Reporter Anna Tintakalis from the California Report has more.
The union says it now has a plan in place, a work stoppage across all 23 CSU campuses. The union's 26,000 members include counselors, librarians, and coaches. They want a 5% pay increase. The administration is offering 2%. Faculty Union President Jennifer Egan.
The state budget is very healthy right now. The CSU has gotten increased funding. Times are good now.
The faculty union is still waiting on an independent fact-finding report due in 6 weeks to determine whether or not to actually pull the trigger on a system-wide strike. The administration says they're offering a 2% raise because they're balancing facility upgrades and increased student enrollment. For the California Report, I'm Anna Tintakalis.
A hospital in Syria run by Doctors Without Borders was destroyed by missiles early this morning. The attack was reportedly launched by either Russian or Syrian forces, according to a spokesperson for the international nonprofit organization. The local head of Doctors Without Borders said the bombing appeared to be deliberate. The hospital was hit by 4 missiles in the space of 2 minutes, leaving at least 7 people dead and another 8 reported missing and presumed dead. About 15 other homes and structures in the area were also hit, including 2 other healthcare facilities that were not operated by the nonprofit. Back in October, a Doctors Without Borders hospital in Kunduz, province of Afghanistan, was destroyed by American forces in what was described by many as a war crime, and by others, including the U.S. military, as a tragic mistake.
The Vatican says Pope Francis has presented a decree to Mexican indigenous peoples approving the use of the Aztec language Nahuatl in Mass. Francis celebrated a Mass in three other indigenous languages Monday during a visit to the southern state of Chiapas. Official approval for these languages is still pending. However, the Vatican spokesman told reporters today that the fact Francis celebrated a Mass in which readings, prayers, and the gospel were read out in those languages is a sign that they're allowed to be used.
As Libya continues to descend into lawlessness, the two separate governments that claim to represent the country have agreed to form a unity government. Since the 2011 NATO-led effort that ousted longtime President Muammar Gaddafi, the country has been ruled by two separate governments, both of which control little territory but claim to represent the country. Like Syria and Iraq, large areas of the country are controlled by various terrorist organizations, including Daesh. As Syrian troops backed by Russian airstrikes continue to drive Daesh back, the terrorist group has increasingly moved into Libya. Last week, Daesh aggressively attacked the country's oil infrastructure, threatening to overrun militias guarding the country's oil wells. The Obama administration says the United States is looking to take decisive military actions in Libya to stop the spread of Daesh terrorist groups, including the possible use of airstrikes and U.S. Special Force Command raids.
A new medical survey of children near the Fukushima nuclear power plant has revealed a sharp rise in the level of diagnosed thyroid cancers. 16 new cases of thyroid cancer in children up to age 18 were discovered over the last year, to bring the total to almost 120 cases of cancer in children near the nuclear power plant that melted down in 2011. The medical survey tests approximately 300,000 children per year for thyroid abnormalities. In addition to the 116 confirmed cases of cancer, another 50 children tested positive for thyroid abnormalities suspected to be cancerous but awaiting final testing. Before the 2011 nuclear meltdown, the average was 2 cases per year per 1 million children, meaning that the Fukushima area has experienced an almost 15-fold increase in childhood thyroid cancer cases since the disaster at the Fukushima nuclear power plant occurred.
A new study has found that up to 4 billion people, more than half the world's population, face a water shortage for at least 1 month each year. The study, along with recently released research from NASA, shows water tables worldwide dropping to dangerous levels. Overconsumption has led to water shortages, lack of clean drinking water for billions of people, land subsidence, and aquifers becoming inundated with salt water. India and China have the largest numbers of people affected by water shortages, followed by Bangladesh, Pakistan, Mexico, and Nigeria.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.immc.org for Monday, February 15th, 2016. Israeli troops injured 28 Palestinians during invasions in the West Bank. Meanwhile, in Gaza, Navy ships attacked fishermen. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers invaded on Monday at dawn the Al-Amari refugee camp in the central West Bank district of Ramallah and injured at least 28 Palestinians. Eyewitnesses said that several armored Israeli military vehicles and jeeps invaded Al-Amari refugee camp and surrounded a Palestinian home near the Umm Ash-Sharayat area in Al-Bira town. The invasions pushed several youngsters to hurl stones and empty bottles on invading soldiers, while the army fired live rounds, rubber-coated steel bullets, and gas bombs. Medical sources said that 23 Palestinians were shot with live rounds and 5 with the illegal 2-2 live rounds, which detonate upon impact, causing a larger and more excessive damage, while many others suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation. The Israeli army said that one soldier sustained a mild injury after a stone hurled by a protester struck him in the knee. In related news, the soldiers invaded Nablus in northern West Bank and clashed with many local youth, wounding one Palestinian with a live round in his arm. Moreover, Israeli soldiers kidnapped overnight and on Monday morning 24 Palestinians in different parts of the occupied West Bank, largely in the Ramallah and Al Bira districts and Nablus. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers opened fire on Monday morning on several Palestinian farmers in the southern part of the Gaza Strip, while Navy ships fired live rounds on fishing boats in Gaza territorial waters. Local news sources reported that Israeli soldiers stationed in the Kisufim military base across the border fence east of Khan Yunis fired many live rounds targeting Palestinian farmers, forcing them to leave their lands. In addition, Israeli Navy ships opened fire on a number of fishing boats in Gaza territorial waters, only 4 nautical miles away from shore, northwest of Gaza City. The fishers returned to shore without fishing to avoid further Israeli violations and assaults. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, February 15th, 2016 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Badmura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sarah Meyer, Don Zur, Jeff Henderson, and Ken Jones. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Special thanks to Janka Soderberg. Our engineer is Daniel Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. Or look us for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, host Joe Uris leads a discussion of the looming clash on Capitol Hill over the nomination of the next Supreme Court justice. At 9 on Alternative Radio, journalist and activist Arun Gupta speaks on terrorism, climate change, and capitalism. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Stage and Studio, host D. May Roberts talks with Shalonda Sims about the Who I Am Celebrating Me performance, highlighting African-American history, and James Canfield returns to Oregon Ballet Theater with Romeo and Juliet. And finally, at 11:30 on Art Focused, host Joseph Gallivan interviews longtime drawing teacher Phil Sylvester about his drawing show Countenance at Gallery 114.
And stay tuned now for an interview with Ellen Thomas, an activist with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, who is currently touring the country, drumming up support for her H.R. 1976, a bill in Congress to abolish nuclear weapons.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Ellen Thomas and Carol Erner are co-chairs of the Disarm/End Wars Issue Committee of the U.S. Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. They're on a speaking tour around the U.S. drumming up support for H.R. 1976, the only bill in Congress calling for the abolition of nuclear weapons. Ellen has been part of the Peace Park anti-nuclear vigil, a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week protest across the street from the White House in Lafayette Park. The vigil began in June of 1981 and continued until the death last month of Concepcion Pichotto, who had been part of the vigil since shortly after it started. Ellen Thomas came by the station today to speak with KBOO reporter Jenka Soderberg about the bill and about the history of the Peace Park.
We are very lucky to be joined in the studio today by Ellen Thomas, who is on a West Coast tour to talk about Proposition 1 to end nuclear proliferation in the United States. Ellen, thank you for joining us here at KBOO.
Well, thank you. I'd like to correct that impression, though. I want to get rid of nuclear weapons everywhere.
Not just the United States.
Oh, no, just everywhere.
And you have spent a lifetime really working on that issue. I wonder if you could give us a bit of the history of Proposition 1.
Well, it goes back before. In 1984, I was working for the National Wildlife Federation as the assistant to the CEO, and I was writing, interviewing homeless people and writing a play about homeless people in the Reagan era. It was called The Great People, G-R-A-T-E, and it was about the fact that they were covering over the steam grates that kept homeless people warm during the wintertime. And I was going through Lafayette Park one night, and I saw a very small woman lying on the sidewalk in a ski suit. It was a cold night in March, between two very, very large signs, 8-by-12-foot signs. One of them was a mushroom cloud that said, "Revelation, this need not be our end. It's up to you." And the other one was, "Mr. President, why don't you come out with the forest homeless?" And over the top between the two signs was another narrow sign that said, "Doubting Thomas's Free Philosophical Forum." So I stopped to talk to this woman who turned out to be named Concepcion Pichotto. And I asked her if she did this by herself. She said she had been there for 3 years, which I found astounding, day and night. And she said no, she had a friend. He was a philosopher. His name was Thomas. And the main character in my play was a philosopher who lived on the street and helped people. So I decided I'd come back and meet this guy. So I did the next day. And 3 weeks later, I gave everything I owned to my daughter, quit my job,